Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, pod people, and welcome to Clash of the Titles, the show where two movies with something in common go head-to-head to figure out which one did it best. And on this week's show, in the red corner, Dustin Hoffman dresses as a woman to steal a woman's livelihood. While in the blue corner, Robin Williams dresses as a woman to steal a woman's livelihood.
Sorry, you're too tall.
I can be shorter.
No, I can't use you. Too short.
Oh, I can be taller.
Too moody. Next.
Too old.
Too stubborn.
You're too much trouble.
Too tough.
Too temperamental.
Too pushy.
Too difficult.
Michael, no one will hire you.
Soon everyone will know that she's Dustin Hoffman and he's Tootsie.
To put his family back together, Daniel Hillard needed a job.
Do you have any special skills?
I do voices.
But he found a way.
I'm placing an ad for a housekeeper.
Housekeeper? Could you make me a woman?
To have both.
Wow.
Let's pray.
No. You for Janaya, don't fire.
Papa's got a brand new bed.
So which of these films are we loving and which are we dragging? You're about to find out in Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken!
Hello Clash Podders, I'm Chris Tilley.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
And Alex is sitting this one out for fear of saying the wrong thing and getting cancelled. It's the truth, isn't it? He's scared, isn't he?
It's handy, isn't it?
He's running scared. And it's unprofessional as well, because these are Alex's choices, even though he didn't know they were his choices, because he never consults the Google Doc. So here we are. Thoughts, Vicky? Are we going to be all right with that, Alex, talking about cross-dressing?
I think we'll be just fine, if not better.
Okay. Fair enough.
Oh, no, what do you mean, because he enjoys that occasionally?
Oh,
I suppose
he?
That's true. Well, yeah, you've seen his... Oh, sorry, you're being funny. That's one of those stories that you know already. Yeah, he likes to dress up, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We could do with him on this week's show. And I've forgotten to ask him which one's his favourite. I'll have to text him in a minute because if we draw, we'll have a problem. So I gave a clue last week due to Alex's silence, and that was something about both these films being a drag. Everyone then guessed movies about drag queens.
Mm.
So I followed that up by making references to the high collars both these characters wear to hide their Adam's apples. And everyone guessed movies about drag queens again. So that didn't work. But the answer was Tootsie and Mrs. Doubtfire. And we have a winner. And that winner is... well, I think someone got there earlier, but then I lost the tweet or they deleted it. So the first person I can see is... Marion Baudet.
Yay.
Congratulations, Marion, who said she really hopes it's these two. So that's nice.
That's nice.
What's her prize, Vicky?
So a lady will come and do your hoovering for a bit and some dancing.
Yes.
And I can sort that out for you. It's not a problem.
A normal lady?
Yes.
Or a special lady?
No, let's just have a lady do
okay,
it.
A
let's
lady.
Just have. Let's not take any more money from women.
Okay, good point. Right, so connection section.
Oh, so a cisgender actor man down on his luck dresses up as a woman who is a better version of his male self. Then they have a shower to hide their disguise. They are attacked in the street by or with a man. False teeth are very prominent. And then they ask very personal questions to a woman about her love life.
Very personal.
Yeah.
Slightly uncomfortable. Like I said, clothed with high collars.
I hadn't actually noticed.
Yeah, that's sort of doing the behind the scenes rather than do anything there. They just decided to dress them both with the high collars.
Makes
and therefore,
sense. Yep.
Job done. Cross-dressing women, getting told how unattractive they are over and over again.
Yeah, that's the... That's
these
the,
people get battered with their looks.
That's the big joke. did you know they're both now, like really recently, they've both been turned into musicals?
Ooh, I knew Doubtfire had. I didn't know Tootsie had.
Yeah. Yeah.
On Broadway or just sort of off-Broadway kind of thing?
One of the... Doubtfire was in Seattle. Yeah. So then was going to be a really famous Seattle theatre. Tootsie, I can't remember from my research. I don't know. But yeah, both musicals, both did not go down brilliantly well because updating the conceit is pretty tricky.
Yes. Yeah.
Just leave the conceit in the past.
Yeah, we've done it.
Yeah. And it was...
It worked then. It might not work now. Yeah. It definitely doesn't work now.
Yeah.
Lying to your boss is sort of a trait of both of these films.
Yes.
Scary nannies. There's a scary nanny in Tootsie.
There is,
yeah. Mrs. Crawley. Yeah. I guess Mrs. Doubtfire isn't scary. Maybe she looks scary. And now I'm doing it. All right, connection's done. So let's get on with it. On Thursday, Vicky is turning this podcast into a nanny state. wait for it. Meaning today I'm turning Dustin Hoffman into Dustin Hoffwoman.
That shouldn't be funny.
Get in.
I love it.
Let me take you on a journey. A social commentary about sexism in the workplace, written, produced and directed by men? That's Tootsie, a film in which Dustin Hoffman plays an actor who can't get a job because he's difficult, so dresses as a woman because women are less difficult. Though he then gets the job because the woman he's pretending to be is difficult. It's all very confusing, as are the many triangles in this film, as Dustin's Dorothy falls for his co-star, whose dad falls for him/her, as does another of his co-stars and the woman whose role he stole. But none of that really matters, as the movie ends with an acting masterclass from Hoffman, playing an actor, playing an actress, playing a character, improvising a speech which he helped write. Presenting for your podcasting pleasure, Tootsie. So, Vicky.
Yeah.
When did you first see this?
Like 2 days ago.
Awesome.
Yeah, I know. I'd never seen it. And so it was, you know, I always say that Mark Parsons always refers to the Halliwell's Guide as to, which hasn't been updated, as well, not in our house since, I don't know, 93 or something. Mm-hmm. So anything post 93 is definitely not interested in because it's not in the Halliwell's Guide. So Tootsie, he couldn't, he's like, is that a 3-star film or a 4-star film? He was unsure, but it's just one we've never got around to watching together. And he's wanted to watch it for a while and so did I. So it was a fun, an unusual podcast experience, really, in that I was like, let's watch a film together for the podcast. And Mark went, yeah, all right then.
Wow.
So that was good.
I watched it with someone who hadn't seen it before as well.
Yeah, we both enjoyed it.
Good, yeah.
Yeah, we did.
Georgina enjoyed it. Yeah.
There you go.
Well, my history is different. I mean, this film has always been around for me because it came out in 82. So it was in the video store by the time I was about 6. It was such a big release. I mean, it was the second most successful film of 1982 behind E.T.
Oh, right.
Which is mad.
Yeah.
And so I remember there being tons of copies of it in the video store, I guess renting it or my folks renting it and watching it or watching bits of it and just not really understanding it.
Yeah.
That's the trouble. I mean, this is not a film for little kids. But
no.
I happened to see it when I was a little kid. And so revisited again a few years later when I was in my big Bill Murray phase. And
I didn't even know he was in it.
Mm.
So when he shut, at first I didn't have my correct glasses on. I think I've become allergic to my other glasses. They make my nose itch. And so anyway, that's a different story. So I was staring at the telly and I was like, is that Bill Murray in the kitchen? And I was like, I think so. And then the minute he spoke, I was like, wow, amazing.
Yeah. It's pre-Ghostbusters Bill Murray, but he was still a star in America because of Saturday Night Live and Caddyshack. And he's uncredited in this film. They sort of agreed, let's just have it be a surprise for the audience that you're in.
Nice.
It. So they didn't really promote or publicise it.
Okay.
But yeah, so, I mean, I found it kind of funny, bits of slapstick in it. But yeah, it wasn't until I watched it when I was a little bit older and I got a bit more out of it. So here we are. Let's talk about behind the scenes, because it's actually quite interesting, this one.
Okay.
3-year process getting this film written. There's sort of two ways it started. It kind of started with Dustin Hoffman and his friend Murray Shizgle talking about what they called the Shirley inside every man. Does every man have a woman who wants to get out? Was this discussion they had? But they were also questioning if masculine behaviour is learned.
Mm-hmm.
And they were wondering, if they'd been born a woman, would they be treated differently?
Yes. I'll just answer that for you now. Yes, you would.
A lot of the questions here could be answered here. So they wrote a draft of a script together called Shirley. And at the time, there was a tennis player called Renee Richards in the headlines because she had had male-to-female sex reassignment.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a big story. So they were writing a script about a tennis player.
Mm.
But they couldn't make it work. At the same time, another script was floating around Hollywood about an unemployed male actor who cross-dresses to get jobs by a guy called Don McGuire. And Hoffman read that and did a deal behind the scenes, and these projects merged, and Hoffman decided to make his character an actor rather than a tennis player, and he decided to make it autobiographical because Dustin Hoffman is famously one of the most difficult actors to ever live, and so he made his actor him, joke at his own expense.
Okay.
The studio suggested getting Larry Gelbart on board to write. He created and produced MASH on TV.
Right.
So, and there is, I think there's a real sitcom vibe to this movie. Especially in the music, but we'll get to that.
Oh, my God.
And they spent a year meeting and talking and doing improvisations. Hal Ashby was brought on board to direct.
Right.
He left due to previous commitment, but there's some great footage of him doing costume tests with Dustin Hoffman back when Hoffman wasn't playing her as sort of a Southern belle and has a slightly higher pitched voice and blonde hair. It's very different. But Michael Ovitz, the super agent, was Hoffman's agent, and he was also Sidney Pollock's agent. So he sent it to Pollock, and Pollock thought the joke was overextended, and he said, "I don't know what this is about." So he turned it down. And then I keep getting this guy's name wrong. Murray Shizgal met with him and pitched it. He said, "It's the story of a person who becomes a better man by becoming a woman."
Right.
Which is kind of the line they try and use at the end
of the movie.
Yeah. Pollock said yes, but brought Elaine May on board to sort out some of the plot and the women characters. And Elaine May is this amazing woman in Hollywood who doesn't get the credit she sort of deserves because she did a lot on The Graduate. She did a lot on this. She did just a lot of work without getting her name on the films. So the first thing May did was to introduce a roommate. I think you would like that as a screenwriter. because Hoffman said, "No, I'm a 40-year-old man. Why am I going to be living with another man?"
Well, then you've got to talk to yourself all the time. So that's exactly. No good, is it?
Exactly. How she put it was, "That's your shadow. That's who you talk to." But he said, "No, I'm not doing it. I cannot figure out who I would live with at this age." And then he went to a party and he met Bill Murray, and they went back and drank till the early hours. Yeah, and he phoned her up and said, "I'd live with Bill Murray."
And only Bill Murray. So if you can't get him, unwrite this.
Well, that's kind of how it happened with this film, with a lot of things. They got Bill Murray and she wrote Bill Murray into it.
Brilliant.
And Elaine May then said to Hoffman, "Terry Garr needs to be in this film. I'm writing a role for Terry Garr."
Right.
And he said, "But what if there's not a place for in the film?" And she just said, "I'm writing a role for Terry Garr." And so that's how we got the Sandy character.
Okay.
Signed her up, brought her on board. As Pollock put it, "We didn't have time to write a complex love story, so we cast someone really fit as the female lead." So Jessica Lange, as he put it, "It needed to be love at first sight."
Yeah.
So they cast her based on her looks, which is harsh. And she said she found it quite hard because she's not a comedic actress. She hadn't done any comedy. She wasn't comfortable doing comedy. And she does kind of play the straight role anyway. So, I mean, she won an Oscar for this.
Mm.
So it worked out fine. But yeah, I'm not sure they went into that with the right intentions. Gelbart based that character on his daughter because he said his daughter kept getting together with the wrong guy.
Don't we all?
Have you?
No, I haven't. I managed to swerve that, but I think. What?
But he said he could see this form of masochism in his daughter where she just kept going back to the wrong guys. And so that's how he wrote Julie. Harsh on his daughter.
A little bit. Thanks, Dad.
The only other bit of casting, Dabney Coleman was cast as the agent.
Yes.
But Hoffman didn't like it because he saw him as too much of a peer. And as they were putting this film together, he was having these huge arguments with Sidney Pollock. Mm-hmm. And he looked up to him and could get scared of him. And so he said, "You're my agent.
Yeah.
Come back to acting," because he hadn't acted in 20 years, "and play the agent." And Pollock refused, as he refused a lot of things on this film. But he convinced him with a bunch of flowers. Pollock played the agent. And then they gave Dabney Coleman the director role, the sleazy director, that Coleman then based on Pollock.
Right, okay.
Which is not all that flattering when you think about it, but the way he dresses and his hand movements were based on Pollock. Let's just hope his behaviour wasn't.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because there's a scene, we'll talk about it when we get there, but Gina Davis is in this film, which I didn't know also, mm-hmm. but she's mostly naked.
Mm-hmm.
So
she's not naked.
Sorry, she's got a very sheer bra
yes.
and knickers on. And that's it. And it happens a couple of times. Then you think, God, if you're Gina Davis, how do you feel about that? Like you're in this like very seminal, groundbreaking work that everybody loves. And you're in it mostly in your knickers. So then I was like, well, Sydney Pollack, you've done the thing that you're lampooning. You've got an act. She doesn't need to be in her pants. Like all it is to show that this is a women's dressing room and that maybe a man dressed as a woman would be uncomfortable or shouldn't be in that room.
Mm-hmm.
But it is quite demeaning to do, especially to repeat it as
Agreed.
Well.
It's there for a visual joke, but how she got cast, she was not an actress.
Right.
She was a model. And they found her in a Victoria's Secret brochure because they wanted someone that would look good in their underwear.
Yeah, no shit.
So that's how she ended up with the role. But when she got on set, they liked her so much, they ended up writing her more lines and more scenes, and that launched an amazing acting career. But mm-hmm. it's funny how that happened.
It's pretty standard, I think.
Yeah, they're not always good actors, though.
That's 100% true, yeah. You do look good, but it isn't working.
So they spent a lot of money and time trying to get the look right, and this was hundreds of thousands of dollars over quite a long period of time. On getting the script right, but also getting the look right, because they all agreed we can't do this if Hoffman can't pass as a woman. And so the Adam's apple was hidden behind shirts. As I said, they pulled the skin up with a wig and rubber bands holding his skin in place. They hid the maleness of his eyes behind those big glasses. And Hoffman said they spent a long time figuring out the size of his breasts.
Right. To be proportionate, I guess, to the old hip to waist ratio.
Mm.
Otherwise you fall over like Barbie.
Yes.
Not me. But Barbie, a doll would fall over in real life.
Good.
Okay, good.
So he would spend 3 hours putting on makeup to cover up his stubble. I talked about that screen test. It's very different. Husky voice in the screen test. But yeah, he went with the sort of higher southern bell thing. And then he went to the Russian tea room, as you see in the movie. He saw John Voight. And he complimented John Voight on a performance, and John Voight didn't figure it out.
That it was Dustin Hoffman?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's when he knew he nailed it. And to be fair, watching it with someone who'd never seen it before, it took them quite a few seconds to clock that that was Dustin Hoffman in the scene in the film.
Okay.
Yep.
So not only has she not seen it, she didn't know anything about it. Is that what you're saying?
She did not know it was about cross-dressing. I didn't even let her see the cover of the film because it gives it away.
I mean, it is impressive.
It really is.
Yeah.
So, finally, before we get into the movie, I want to get into some juicy quotes. So I've read a lot of quotes from Hoffman on this, and I've seen him talk about it a lot. So this is how Wikipedia describes it, because it's a bit all over the place what he says, but this is what he said. He was shocked that although he could be made up to appear as a credible woman, he would never be a beautiful one, and that he had epiphany when he realised that although he found this woman interesting, he would not have spoken to her at a party because she was not beautiful, and that as a result, he had missed out on many conversations with interesting women.
We're all right, Dustin. You can move on. Don't worry about it. Go and talk to the pretty ones.
And then other stuff I picked up in these interviews. Men ignored him when he walked into a room dressed as Dorothy. He couldn't believe how callous they could be. He hated how he disappeared when he walked into rooms. And then he said he felt like men wouldn't be interested in this woman and she wouldn't compromise herself for a man. So she would ignore that and focus on her work.
Right.
I feel like he's taking a lot of the wrong things away from this.
Yeah. It's just hard to hear a man go, oh, wow, it is different, isn't it? And it is quite hard.
Yeah. And that's a good point. But also, did it take him doing this for him to realise that he only hooked up with pretty girls in rooms?
Yeah.
You know?
Did someone like put him in a lineup and he's like, oh, now that you've done that.
Oh, yeah, I do ignore munters. Never occurred to me.
I hadn't realised until I had to be one.
And also the way he talks about it, you'd think he was Warren Beatty.
And this is the thing, does he know what he looks like?
Because pre The Graduate, I don't think Hoffman...
The whole thing, I'm a character actor. Yeah, you are. Like, you don't...
After The Graduate, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
He's rich and famous. He's banging everything
it
that moves.
It makes a difference,
But
yeah.
Before then, I don't think he's getting all this that he's claiming he is.
He's got a wonderful face for a character actor.
So anyway, that's a bit uncomfortable. And it does sort of play into what we'll talk about when we talk about the film, what it gets slightly wrong. But anyway, very quickly, regarding the shoot, the big thing they all agreed on was that they wouldn't play it for laughs. They played it straight, and Hoffman said it was, we shot it like a Chekhov play. It was all about finding the honesty and authenticity. So shall we see if they succeeded?
Sure.
Right, let's talk about the movie. And I'm starting off with a section called Meet Michael Dorsey. So I do like this opening sequence because he's applying makeup to himself.
Yes.
Setting up that he's got the skills.
It's important, isn't it? Because when Dorothy appears, I think it's because I watched them out of order. I watched Mrs. Doubtfire first, and there's such extensive, brilliant montage work about getting to the look. And then when he makes the decision later to become Dorothy, he's like, oh, where did she come from? Like, who is she based on? What did it look, you know, what was your first attempt? Like, you've just nailed it straight away. So this little insert here is fine. I miss a montage. Obviously, I love a montage, but fine.
Yeah, it's the same smash cut that they use in Some Like It Hot, I think.
Yes.
Where they're going to dress as women, bang, they're women.
They've done it,
they
yeah.
don't bother with the montage. So we've got a lot of acting business here. There's an acting class he's teaching. He actually pulled in a local classroom up the road and improvised with them,
yeah.
which I thought was quite sweet. And he really wanted, you know, Hoffman is playing himself here because Michael Dorsey loves acting and he wanted to show that the character loves acting. And so the advice he's giving is real. That's what he's always say to actors. There is no work. I think he's always had a chip on his shoulder, Hoffman, because it took him so long to make it and he was unemployed for so long. So he's sort of talking the truth.
I think he does a brilliant job of making you sympathetic towards actors, which sometimes it can be shorthand for like clowns or can't get a job or, you know, swerving in quote marks real work. And I was really taken on the journey of like, this is a hard life if you choose to do it because there is no work, 95% unemployment and all the rest of it. And there's obviously a craft at the centre of it. But I don't know, the temptation is when someone says, oh, I'm an actor, you're like, okay, whatever. But the kernel of what's true about it, I think they really get to it in this film.
I hadn't appreciated how hard it was until I went freelance. And the constant rejection as a freelancer is similar to the constant rejection as an actor. It's worse with an actor, I think, because you're putting everything out there.
Yes.
But I understand that pain a bit more now, and it does capture it. He's. They need someone older. They're looking for someone younger. He's the wrong height. We're looking for someone different. I can be different. We're looking for someone else. But within a couple of minutes, we're right into the story. But he doesn't seem like that good an actor to me.
It gets better. So the first one he does, I can't remember where he's... What's the monologue he's doing when he's in the sort of tuxedo? That's really good.
Is it Death of a Salesman?
It's something really good.
Yeah, Iceman Cometh.
The Iceman Cometh. Yeah. But prior to that, you're like, no, you don't. I thought the film was saying he doesn't really deserve these jobs because although he loves the craft, as a man, he's not even a good actor. And so it will all come together when he dresses up as Dorothy. But then when he's got the tuxedo and he's doing the read and he says something like, oh, is my acting disturbing your sleeping or whatever it is in the theatre? You're like, oh, okay, I get it now. Like, you are excellent. I don't know. There's just a huge gear shift between the other auditions and whatever he's doing there.
Okay.
And then I understood, which is, I think, a bit problematic for the film later because it's like, everybody loves him. He's a brilliant actor. He is so entitled. It's unreal. And I was like, okay, the trouble is because you're setting him up as like good, his behaviour at the party, I was like, oh, you're the hero, you're meant to be a good person, a good actor, everybody loves you, and the way you are at that party doesn't sit quite right with me.
Well, yeah, so it's a surprise birthday party. They didn't really script it. Elaine May says you can't write a party.
Okay.
So I write you a roadmap and then you have a party.
So when he touches a woman's chest and says, that's a pretty blouse, that's not even in a script. He just did that by himself.
Well, here's a question. He's creeping on quite a lot of girls in that party. And as you say, it makes him very unsympathetic. He keeps using the same line over and over again. I wondered if this is a 1982 thing where we're going to dress our protagonist as a woman. We need to show that he's straight.
Yeah, there's that. And also, I got it after I'd seen it. On a second view, and you'd be like, oh, at this point in your life, you are, quote marks, a bad man. You're going to become a good man by dressing up as Dorothy and connecting with Julie and all the rest of it. But we're showing you that you're disrespectful of women and you're bad. So to touch someone's chest and say, that's a nice blouse, is like, that's gross. Get your hands off. But then it's like, I found it challenging because it's like, that you're the hero. I'm supposed to be rooting for you at this point.
Yeah, and I think although he does become a better person, he's still trying to get into Julie's pants. Under sort of false pretenses.
Just locking eyes with her over some scattered papers.
But also under false pretenses and by being dishonest with her. So in that respect, I've got a real problem with Michael Dorsey. And I think even as a kid, I found this very uncomfortable. There was just too much of this dishonesty in the film that I found it hard to get my head around. Or it was dishonesty for the wrong reasons, whereas maybe on Thursday, the dishonesty is coming from a better place.
A purer place.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we've got Bill Murray improvising a load of stuff here.
All that's brilliant.
Yeah. And it's funny. It's funny watching the documentary. They talk about how
the theatre in the rain. It
It's so good because you know it's improv as well, but it's just so funny and you never know where he's going to go next. I haven't seen it before. I didn't, just a treat, such a treat for me. I didn't even know he was in it. And it's like, we're going to get a good 5 minutes of good Murray.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it when he says, I love it when people say, I loved your play. What happened? they asked him to improvise this theatre, this playwright who was pretentious and talking bullshit, but they didn't tell the extras that's what he was doing.
Right.
And so they didn't know whether to be enthralled by him or laughing at him.
Yeah.
And it's funny, you can see the look of confusion on their face. And every time they cut back, there's less people around him because he's just losing that audience.
But also there's a double thing going on there because he is Bill Murray. He's a huge star at this point. You're assorted actors around a table being told to just go with it as Bill Murray does this legendary improv. If you don't laugh at him, then later on, when you're like, oh, Bill, do you remember me from so-and-so? Could you help me? No, fuck you, I can't do that. So that false laughter that famous people get, famous men definitely get a lot of, there's probably some of that going on as well because they want another gig.
Yeah.
Maybe.
No, it's funny. It's funny watching their faces. So he's got to help Sandy, his friend of 6 years who, I don't know, is there a connection there? I guess there is. She's got to prep for a soap opera audition. They do the prep, but the next day she's not allowed to read. And then Michael goes to see his agent at CAA, George, played by the director Sidney Pollack. And you can see why Hoffman suggested bring him in as the agent, because their back and forth is very natural.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
And Pollack seems like an agent, doesn't
he? Yes, he does.
I mean, you've got more experience with agents than I do, but is that a believable agent?
In the US, yeah, definitely. Like, you know, just the focus on the bottom line, but also the exasperation and also the... He seems really close to firing him because he's not making any money. Whereas I think here, because it's a bit more of a sort of boutique industry, you do look after people. I believe like talent agents do look after people that maybe they're not bringing in loads of money, but there's such a special relationship and they really feel for them and there's and all of that. But obviously over there, there's so much money to be made. You don't want any dead weight. Mm. And it just reminded when I first started and there was always that phrase, like, I can't get them arrested. I can't get them arrested. And I sort of didn't really get it. And then I did. And I was waiting for him to say that to sort of like punch the air in recognition. But just to be in CAA and anyway, and just to have him play in that sort of archetype, I really liked it.
Yeah. And they set out the movie Central Problem here. Even though we've seen it, they tell us it. George says, you argue with everybody, no one will hire you.
Yeah.
Bang. We get a smash cut to Dorothy Michaels, but we'll meet her after this short break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband,
I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, "I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit," and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, "Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?"
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we'll weigh around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Right, we're into a section I'm calling Meet Dorothy Michaels, because boom, that Some Like It hot cut happens. Dorothy Michaels appears. As I said, it took my missus a few seconds to twig that was Dustin Hoffman, not knowing that that's what this film was about. And she was, yeah, big smile when she realised.
Yeah.
And so we meet the director, Ron, played by Dabney Coleman, who says Dorothy, who's gone for the part that Sandy went for, is not right. They're looking for a very specific physical type.
What does that mean?
I actually wasn't sure what that meant. Did they want her to be more glam or...
I think I took it to be pretty. That's what I meant. He doesn't want to say it because you can't say that, but that's what you say.
Yeah. But Dorothy isn't taking that. She threatens to knee him in the balls. And so she's immediately becoming successful by resorting to what the film posits as traditionally this male trait and this...
Yeah.
This, the reason he's not getting parts. I do find the message quite confusing.
Me too. Because when he's with Sandy earlier and they're doing the rehearsal... Sorry, she's going to audition and she's like, "I'm not going to get the part." And he's like, "What's the part?" "Oh, it's a woman." So they're running through the reed and he's like, "You can't access your rage. What is this? You know, you need to be enraged." So I feel like I really enjoyed the film, but then sometimes I'd step away and think, God, is the message here a man saying to the girls, "Hey, sisters, listen, if you just lean into these feelings, you'll get everything you want." Like, it's never occurred to us that that's what we could do. There are so many other roadblocks to not acting like that that aren't just, "Oh, I never thought of it," or "I can't do it." And he doesn't ever, Dustin Hoffman will never understand that kind of thing. And I found that irritating.
Good. I did as well. Yeah. And I didn't know if I got it wrong, because this has been so acclaimed for being so ahead of its time that it feels like the actual central message is a bit wonky.
The purest thing I could, like, emotion was when after Dorothy sort of gets in the room and nails the reed and they're like, "Oh, you've got the part." And I was like, I don't know what you saw in her then that made you change your mind. It's meant to be this big moment where she said to the director, "Oh, power makes a woman masculine, shame on you." And that she's still feminine, but powerful and enraged. And I didn't see that in Dorothy either. So I was very confused that she got the part. I just went along with it.
Yep. First of the many lines about how ugly Dorothy is, "I'd like to make her a little more attractive. How far can you pull back? How about Cleveland?"
God, and later on when they make Sandy say she's fat, it's like she's like a blade thin person. I think Sandy's a brilliant character, but it's like, are you just saying that because you're cross? But there's no way you can describe Dorothy as fat. Like, not in a million, you should do that anyway, but like, she definitely also isn't.
It's a weird line, that one, isn't it? Yeah, she should have said she's ugly.
then it would be fine.
We've got that Russian tea room scene that happened in real life. Dorothy asks George for directions. He doesn't recognise her. Then she sits with him. In that scene, she's supposed to grab Sidney Pollack's hand, but Dustin Hoffman grabbed his balls.
Women do that all the time. And so.
No, you don't see it. It's still supposed to be him grabbing his hand because it's under the table.
But
his reaction is a man who's having his balls grabbed.
Sure.
And they had a huge row on set because actually, guess what? You aren't actually allowed to do that.
You're not allowed to do it. It doesn't matter if you're actually a man underneath women's clothes. Don't do it.
No.
Don't do it. It was uninvited and consent was not given. And it's not funny.
Turns out Hoffman does have form. I don't know if we'll talk about that later, but there's been allegations which make this film even weirder.
That's why the blouse thing really threw me, because, you know, you've had certain thoughts about Dustin Hoffman for years and years and years, and then they're being slightly upended. And then you see that blouse thing, and then you've just told me it's probably not even scripted, and you just think, oh, man, like, that's not good, is it? Why would it occur to you to do that sort of thing? Why would you do that on film?
Dustin.
Oh, Dustin.
So the scene where he loses, or he doesn't lose the cab to a nebbish guy.
Mm.
In the script, he did lose the cab to that nebbish guy.
Mm.
And then Hoffman was the one that said, I wouldn't lose my cab to this guy.
No.
And so he did what they called a freebie, which was, you know, he would get to do his take after they'd done what was in the script.
Okay.
And his take is what ends up in the film, because it's a funny moment when he throws the guy on the floor.
It's funny, but it's that it's such a complicated feeling, because and then it's repeated in Mrs. Doubtfire as well, when someone tries to steal Mrs. Doubtfire's bag. And you think, oh, do you know what? When that happens to me, not that people try and steal my cabs very often, but you know what I mean, you would like to react with a bit of strength and a bit of violence, but you just don't, because chances are, if it's a man doing it, they are going to be more strong than you are, so you don't. And so you're pleased for Dorothy, because you're like, yay, brilliant, you got to do it for us. But then you're like, oh, but that's, you know, there's a man under there, so it's not the same thing.
I think there are a lot of jokes in this film that are those kind of jokes, where it's a funny bit of physical comedy, but it actually undermines the message of the movie.
Michael
can't tell Sandy that they cast a man instead of her, so he starts lying to her about where he's getting money from, and then he sleeps with her.
For a bit of a shit reason. She's like, what are you doing? In your knickers or whatever, in your pants, whatever. I'd lost track of what he was wearing by that point. And he's like, oh, it's because I want to have sex with you. And so thus then kicks off this whole subplot. I thought they could have done a bit better with, you know, why they would sleep together.
Yeah, because... you know, she's supposed to be dating another guy earlier. They don't make it clear that she's pining for him.
Yeah.
But now she starts pining for him straight after this. But I don't know. I quite like her as a character.
I think she's brilliant. And I think the speech she does after they've woken up or got out of bed or whatever, which is like, just tell me now, is really, really insightful and good and done brilliantly. And he doesn't listen at all, obviously. He completely starts lying to her and deceiving her and standing her up and stuff like that. But she's so good in that scene.
You love to collapse a character. And I wonder if we just didn't need the Julie character, and the Sandy character could have been...
yeah.
That part, whether Sandy's on the soap or whatever it is, I think they could have figured it out, because, you know, you want a character that there's an on-off thing happening with. And so for there to be two at the same time, I just think it's a bit messy.
Yeah.
We get a getting ready montage to this bloody awful song, Go Tootsie Go. Jesus, what were they? It's proper sitcom territory, like bad sitcom territory. But we've got the Gina Davis scene here. He hits his head on the door and starts talking about the table. The other reason they cast her was for her height, because they wanted the visual gag to be that her breasts were in Dustin Hoffman's face.
Hilarious.
Well, you are laughing. He meets John Vanderhorn, played by Commandant Lassard from Police Academy. Vicky, yeah. You like talking about how they come up with names. He's called Van Horn.
Yeah, he is. Do you know, this week again, I'm stumped.
Yeah.
I have nothing. Nothing for you.
Listeners, later if you on, can think maybe, of what they yeah. call the horny man Van Horn, let us know. Now we're into the third section. Meet Emily Kimberly, because they're shooting this soap opera, and Michael playing Dorothy is playing the hospital administrator, Emily Kimberly. She goes off book to avoid kissing Van Horn, and people seem to like it. Then the director calls her Toots, doesn't like him condescending. Then Van Horn forces a kiss on her.
Yeah, and we all laugh our heads off. Oh, the 80s. Oh, the ever whatever times, the perennial times.
Not good. Michael says in the next scene, I think Dorothy's smarter than I am. It's quite an interesting statement.
Because it's preceded by Bill Murray saying, how did you get away with it? I ignored him. I did it. Something like, I'm compressing it. I ignored him. I did it my way. And then I apologized afterwards and it was fine. So that's the way he's saying that's how a woman does it, because we're, you know, trying to avoid conflict and it still works. And then maybe Dorothy is smarter to have done that. And I totally get it. And it's such a complicated thing. It's like, at first I was like, yeah, brilliant. You've acknowledged that. And you can see that that's what happens. And all these little decisions you make all the time about how to avoid this and achieve this and do whatever, rather than just saying, I want, kind of thing. But then and I apologize afterwards. It's like, we don't want to apologize. We just want to do it like a man does and not have to apologize. So the apologizing thing in some ways is smart because it saves your skin. But in other ways, it's not something for me, very personally, not something to reach for. I don't want to apologize. If a man wouldn't apologize, I don't want to have to apologize for doing the exact same thing. That's the complicated feeling.
Yeah. He adds, I just wish he was prettier. I'm sure Dustin Hoffman added that line in. But her character takes off. She starts getting fan mail and autographs. And then she meets Julie's dad, Les, played by Charles Durning, who's also a fan of the character and the actress. Julie, as I said, played by Jessica Lange, she's the beautiful star of the soap. She invites him over. He can't find anything to wear. I like that being a woman is giving him these insecurities he never had before.
I love that scene.
It's almost like he's getting a body dysmorphia.
Yeah, yeah.
After a week in a dress.
Because he's thin and fit. He's got nothing to worry about, but it is funny. I mean, I know it's cheap, but talking about I've got nothing to wear and those stripes sit badly and all of a sudden, I think it's very funny.
Yeah, I agree. Julie, they have some girl talk, and Julie says, when I find the one who can give me the worst possible time, that's when I make my move. I'm just saying that because I'm going to come back to that line. He wants to know why she drinks so much. And she says, because it's not fattening. Really? I thought
she's
alcohol was
that.
Quite fattening. Yeah.
It depends. I mean, if she's not sinking like 4 pints of bitter, which I don't think she is.
But isn't wine very sugary?
Wine is sugary. There's that famous quote that I always think of because this is stupid. Like, it's from Twiggy in the 60s. How do you maintain this, you know, your tiny figure? And she's like, I only eat steak and I only drink champagne because, you know, for the calories and whatever. And I think of that a lot. And I think there is a myth that alcohol, I mean, if it's all you have and you don't eat, I guess you are going to lose some weight there.
Yes, definitely.
But then I don't really feel, I think this sort of alcohol dependency is like this little thing running through it. Julie's constantly offering out drinks.
Mm.
But this sort of, it's not fattening and it's not good for me. So is she on this sort of destructive cycle? Like, does that thread get resolved or picked up?
No, it feels a bit judgy, and it's interesting learning that thing about the writer basing it on his daughter. So, and he said that writing this was like a form of therapy. So I think he obviously saw his daughter going through something and put it all into this character.
What I took from it, because after she said the stuff about the drink, is that being a woman in the 80s is really hard. And it's like being a woman trying to cope with all these things, being a single parent and et cetera, has sort of driven her to drink, not as extreme as that sounds, but that's her coping mechanism for the contradictions and the things she has to navigate every day kind of thing.
Yeah. Now, I saw a scene in the documentary behind the scenes of this film, and I'm not sure if it's in the film, so you might have to help me here. During this sequence, do they talk about periods?
No, not the version I saw.
Oh my God. I don't know why they cut this scene out. It's so funny.
It sounds risky, I'll be honest.
I promise you it's funny. So Elaine May described this scene as like he's a spy undercover trying not to get caught.
Sure.
So he's trying not to say the wrong thing, but she asks him, or she mentions her flow, and then she asks him about his flow, and he doesn't know what that's referring to.
Right.
So he says it's been going for months. And it's just really funny. And she's like, what? And so they have this back and forth until he finally figures it out. It's a really funny scene. And I think it's sad they dropped it because it's only about 20 seconds. Julie just wants someone to walk up to her with the truth. We'll come back to that. Back on set, Dorothy's doing more ad-libbing. I love it when she orders the cattle prods for men in the hospital over the phone. That really made me laugh. But she's onto magazine covers now, including one with Andy Warhol.
But why?
What?
Who knows?
Weird.
But fine.
15 minutes of fame, I guess. He has a big conversation with his agent where he says a lot of the lines that feel important to Dustin Hoffman, I think. He says, there's a woman in me. He says, I know what it's like to sit by the phone waiting for it to ring. Yeah, that's bad, isn't it?
Really, really bad.
It's really bad.
So I can be Medea. I can be Lady Macbeth. You can't. Like, you can't. I understand that you're doing a good job as Dorothy Michaels, but I think it's a bit much to say a cis man can understand the full gamut of experience that then enables you to be these tragic heroines and villains from, like, literature. It's just a bit much, but it is fine because it's undercut. I feel like it was undercut. It's like, you know, it's Michael grandstanding and his agent is like, don't be ridiculous, you can't be Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yeah, and I think that's where it's good because I feel like, I think Dustin Hoffman thinks that what Michael's saying here is right, that there is a potentially great actress inside of him. Yeah. But what his agent's saying is actually right.
Yeah.
That this is all bollocks and you need to chuck this in immediately.
Yeah. And the way that it's cut, and so obviously the way it's directed, leaves you, the emphasis feels quite balanced in the scene. You don't come away from the scene thinking, well, the agent was being unreasonable. Of course he could be Lady Macbeth. And you don't come away from it going, well, you know, what a pretentious dickhead for even thinking it. I think it feels really neatly balanced. As it's really impressive that you walk out from the scene, I guess just believing what you actually feel in your heart, which is, I don't think you can be Eleanor Roosevelt kind of thing.
Yeah. Agreed. They go to a high society party and he tries that line out that Julie just told her she wants to hear.
This blew my head off, this scene. What is this scene? So at first, I was like, that's awesome because there's context is everything, or mm-hmm. context is a lot of it. So something you say to a woman that you believe is a woman that's your friend about, it wouldn't it be great if a man was just completely honest, out of context, out of when it happens in the real world, when a man actually says it to you, the context is entirely different. So of course she throws a drink in his face. So I was like, oh wow, that's brilliant. That's acknowledging that context has a role to play and all the rest of it. But then I was like, oh, is it actually bad? Because does it lean into women say one thing and mean another? And you can't trust what a woman says, which then takes you on a really scary path to no doesn't necessarily mean no, because women say one thing and mean another.
No, I felt like it's at his expense.
Good.
And
okay.
It's kind of, it's what we talked about in the Groundhog Day episode, where when you're using these malicious means to get information,
to get
a woman into bed, that's...
So a question to you is the line that she says about, I wish a man would come up and say, what is it, like, we've got a connection, let's just, whatever, hop into bed or something. Is that a famous line? Because it's very specific. And if a man you'd never met at a party came up to you and said it, you'd be like, do you moonlight as Dorothy Michaels then? Because I just said that to her like
no,
2 days ago.
No, I don't think it's a famous line.
So I don't understand why she doesn't go, fuck, I said that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Are you bugging
word
my
for
place?
Word. Yeah.
So she's standing up for women in the workplace here a lot.
And not getting fired, which is interesting.
Yeah.
How's that work?
Yeah.
It just feels like Dorothy's going, if you just said what was on your mind, everything would fall into place.
Mm.
And especially later, Julie's like, you taught me everything. It's like, wow, okay. It does occur to us. It will have occurred to Julie, especially Julie's character. Who's like, you know, she introduces herself. She's like, oh, I'm the hospital slut. And when she does a scene that's quite powerful, she looks really pleased with herself, like some proper acting. And Ron undercuts and is like, you know, stop having this self-congratulatory party kind of thing. So I don't know. It's like, it would have occurred to her, but she, as an actress, would have been fired. And the character, if the character had stood up, the hospital slut, she just would have been killed off. So I don't know. I didn't like it.
No, and I just don't like this implication that only a man could think up these things, that these women couldn't possibly do it for themselves.
I honestly feels like it's not that Michael would even say, I know you've thought of it, but you don't feel you can do it. Mm. It's like you've never even thought.
No.
Because Sandy's there earlier to go, women have no rage. And that's what that scene is about. So I think it's saying that women don't tap into those feelings because they don't exist.
Mm. Right.
And you know me, I'm mad as hell, so...
Terrifying. Right, penultimate section, bizarre love triangle, because Dorothy visits Julie's dad's farmhouse.
This really confused me because I like it. I love a road trip and we're on holiday. First of all, if someone says to you, do you want to come up, stay for the holidays? What, we're sharing a bed? Are you serious right now? Like, I don't care who you are.
Girls do that. No, they do. They do. I'm not going to say they have pillow fights, but they have pillow fights.
I would be absolutely livid. You've tricked me up here, Julie. Mm. Predator, actually. Like, it's unreal that she's like, oh yeah, we're just going to bunk in together. My kid's got a room. I'll sleep on the floor with the baby then. I don't mind.
There's a perfectly good couch.
It's a massive house.
And also, during the farming montage, Julie does stick her finger in Dorothy's mouth, which is quite a strange thing to do while they're cooking.
Yeah, it is. It's
I don't care who the fuck you are. Don't stick your finger in my mouth while I'm cooking.
But also, like you said, Dad fancies Dorothy. Dorothy fancies Julie. Mm. Julie, it feels like in this section to me, wants a new mom. Mm. So I was like, oh, I don't know where to put my emotions. We're entering into... Well, I want it to be rom-com territory because you're trying to get your partner, you're trying to get your girl, and yet there's this huge distraction going on, which is the dad and the fact that your girl thinks that you could be her new mum. That's quite complicated.
Yeah, it is. It is. Our dad talks, he seems to be against women's lib.
Oh, I tell you what, that gave me horrible, like, I found that very triggering. That's like every family party I've ever been to.
I think that's for us to not feel too sad for him when he gets his comeuppance.
Because he's a bit of a dick.
Yeah. She does a speech about purple flowers that's very sweet.
It's oddly... moving.
Yeah.
When I was like, is this the whole story? Mm. That's you chose some wallpaper with your dead mother. But then she's such a good actor that it did work.
Yeah.
But I don't know. In other hands, it veered a bit into sort of Naked Gun territory a little bit.
Yeah. And it's amazing it stayed in the film, actually. It's one of those things that you think would easily, quickly be cut from a comedy.
It's but long. Yeah.
Yeah. Michael strokes her hair, which is quite creepy. But then his wig turns and it's quite funny.
And then she said, oh, my mum used to do that. What's going on?
Right. Emily Kimberly has brokered through. So the studio is giving her another year, which Michael does not want. Now we get an uncomfortable scene where Julie is pouring her heart out to Dorothy and Dorothy makes a move on her. And so, understandably, Julie thinks Dorothy's a lesbian at this point.
Yep.
And so sends her on a date with her dad.
Yeah, because you have to tell him in person for some reason. I just found it annoying. I was like, I don't want this scene. I like the when I got to the scene and with the marriage proposal, I was like, oh, that is fun. But when that was happening, I was like, it feels like we're swerving the big thing.
I agree. They're chucking situations at us which don't fit together logically.
Like a farce almost.
Yes.
Like
she would not suggest he goes to date her dad, and she would not suggest, and he would not go on that date.
After what's just happened.
No. So, it doesn't really ring true. So the proposal happens. He heads home and Van Horn's there. He wants a piece of him too, singing at the window, and then starts trying to shag her.
This is a good scene for me because... So when Bill Murray comes home, there's a brilliant they sidestep it, and because it is heavy, I get why you do it, and it's hard to make it funny. But Bill Murray is like, oh my god, what happened? And then Michael's saying, you know, I was probably a little bit in trouble there, so that's good. It's like you assume that if you were sexually assaulted, you could deal with it, but it turns out you can't. So that's, you know, good to learn that. But Bill Murray says, well, why did you let him in? And so there's a really interesting moment where we could go into some victim blaming, which is super realistic. Like, if that sexual assault had been seen through and Dorothy had gone to the police or whatever, or told her friends, it would have been, well, why you shouldn't have let him in. And they just move away from it, which I totally understand. But I found that quite satisfying.
Yeah. And he says, Commandant Lassard says, sorry, Dorothy, I didn't understand. And it felt to me, watching some of the behind the scenes stuff, is that's how their attitude was to a lot of these male characters, was that actually they're not bad people, they just don't understand that this is not what you do.
Yeah.
Which obviously is not the way we would look at these situations now.
It's a huge conversation, isn't it, about is it just easy to go, oh, I didn't know.
Mm.
Yeah.
Sandy shows up, he gives her some chocolates, she asks if he's gay. He tells her he's in love with another woman, and she storms out and leaves the movie. She gets some great lines here.
Yeah.
But I'm quite sad to see her go.
Me too.
You know, she deserved better because I think, yeah, she's sort of the most, I don't know, she's the one I'd be mates with.
She's brilliant. She's just absolutely brilliant.
She's a real person.
Yeah.
His agent says to him, since when do you care about how other people feel? He's changing, Vicky. And they're telling us that he's changing.
So we were being told, just in case we missed it.
And now we're into the finale, the big reveal, because they've got to redo Emily's party scene live on television. Has a moment with Julie behind the scenes. Julie tells Dorothy that she loves her, but she can't love her.
Mm.
And this is the moment that, yeah, you mentioned, Vicky. She talks about how Dorothy taught her to stop hiding, taught her to be herself, taught her to stand up for herself.
Yeah, by doing what?
Well, I guess by leading by example. But the message is this weak-willed woman just needs the inspiration of a strong man dressed as a woman. Yeah, you know, 100%. It's not the right message, is it?
I'm sure they had good intentions. How do you make it work? And it's like, maybe the thing that I couldn't quite get past is that they've only just met. So what does that say about Julie? That in 2 weeks however long it is, a few months, that, you know, her world has been turned upside down by this strong-willed man just as a woman. Maybe if they, like you say, collapse the characters, maybe if they'd known each other for years, there's something else there. But it didn't sit right with me.
So Emily starts improvising, and there's some amazing acting here from Hoffman, because he's basically written these lines himself, Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah,
and so he's
brilliant.
Improvising them, pretending to improvise them. He improvised the fact that he's Emily Kimberly's brother, Edward Kimberly. and this is all comedy built out of reactions. So the lines aren't necessarily funny, but just cutting to everyone in Dorothy's life is where the laughs come from. We even get Bill Murray at home, Truman Show style, commenting on what he's seeing. Julie punches him in the stomach. And yeah, that's the end. Everyone knows. Next, we've got him sulking in the park.
Yeah, there's no act three in this film, which is bananas.
Mm.
So we've said Sandy just exits stage left and she's never seen again. There isn't an act three. Instead, what we've got is an apology in a bar.
Well, yeah, how Pollock put it was that he's betrayed Julie, he's betrayed Les, and he said what we'd ended up making was, because we'd cast two such good actors, is it felt almost mean and it was quite difficult. So we then needed a series of apologies, which is a weird way to end a film.
Yeah, it's really weird.
Just after he's pushed over a mime.
Yeah.
which was another one of his freebies. It was just supposed to be sulking and walking. And then thankfully, Dustin Hoffman for once went and spoke to the mime and said, I'm going to push you this time.
It is pretty funny.
It's funny. But yeah, you get the, you, as you say, you've got this awkward scene in the bar with Les and then an awkward scene on the street with Julie.
And then we're done.
And then we're done. The back and forth between Michael and Julie is Julie says, I miss Dorothy. And he says, you don't have to. She's right here and she misses you. The better man with you as a woman. Mm. So it's funny. They said they overwrote the line and Hoffman couldn't get it out. So he stumbled over it. And that's what they ended up keeping in the film, that's which cute. I think is good. It's, you know, it feels natural.
Yeah.
But he's got to learn to be a good person without the dress. And then he sort of says, the hard part's over. We're already good friends.
Yeah,
implying we can just have sex now. Because yeah. That's what all friends do.
Yeah. After a few months, weeks, whatever.
And I like the fact that she asks to borrow his yellow outfit. I think it's a good way of her keeping it ambiguous as to how she feels about him.
Yeah, and not burying Dorothy. As yeah. in, that never happened kind
yeah.
of thing.
And they walk up the street and she keeps her hands on her hips, which I really like.
Yeah.
But then it freeze frames on them going suddenly arm in arm. And I'm like, you didn't need to, I wish they'd not done that. Because to me, that implies that there's something there. Yeah. Whereas if she just kept her hands on her hips with him to her side, I would still be questioning, well, are they friends or is something going to happen?
Because, that's a good point.
But also, if they get together, is that the sad ending? Because I'm going to go back to that line she said earlier. She finds the one who can give herself the worst possible time mm-hmm. and then gets involved with him. Mm. Is that what she's doing here with Michael?
Maybe.
I mean, I guess probably not in Hollywood speak, but...
No, 100% not.
No, but it does make me wonder based on the way he's behaved for the last 2 hours.
Yeah.
And that's our ending.
Amazing.
So I was thinking about the poster.
Yeah.
It put Dorothy in front of the Stars and Stripes.
Yes.
Like implying that this is, I don't know, a story America should be proud of. This is...
It's thrown me for years because I know what this film is about because it's really famous. But I always thought there was a big sort of something taking place on a national stage because of the flag. And then I knew that there was a joke about Eleanor Roosevelt because someone said it to me in the pub. And I was like, oh, maybe that's where Dorothy's career takes her, is to the White House in some fashion. But no. So no, I don't know what that is.
Oh, strange. Yeah. I mean...
Misleading.
But it worked because the film was nominated for 10 Oscars.
Right.
10 Academy...
Just by putting a flag on the thing. That's wild.
Well, I'm suggesting maybe it helped think in America that this was some story of US pride. But... yeah, and it made about $180 million from a $20 million budget. And as I said, it was second only to E.T. in 1982. That's
a smash.
That doesn't happen often.
Well, then there you go, Mrs. Doubtfire, second biggest movie of 93. They were both
second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are the chances?
Slim.
Of a knockabout comedy being number two. Very slim.
I love it. I miss those days. And that's it.
Brilliant.
All right, should we do the bits then?
Sure.
What's your favourite scene, Vicky?
Well, it's funny that you did ask me about it. It's when he goes to CAA the first time and Michael has a bit of a set to with his agent and talking. I think George is really, really funny in that scene. And I think Michael comes across as a bit of a prick, which is what you need. And just talking about being a tomato. And I just thought it was hilarious and very satisfied. I do also like the magazine montage because I do like a montage. And it's a montage and a makeover in one.
Yep.
So double points from me.
It's funny you say the tomato thing. That's based on something real. So do you know Zero Mostel?
No.
He's the guy in The Producers that isn't Gene Wilder.
Oh, right.
He's the other guy. Incredibly funny. Hoffman said he saw him do a one-man show where he played a bunch of vegetables.
Right.
And so he'd seen it done. He'd seen someone convincingly pull off a tomato.
Sorry.
I mean, I should reword that. He'd seen... Oh, I'm not going to bother.
Once you've seen that, and it's something you can't unsee because you think, how do you do it? But it can be done.
Ketchup came out.
Oh!
What?
Oh! I don't know why I'm doing that. I don't know any tomatoes to feel bashful around.
My scene is all those reactions to the big reveal at the end. I just think it's a really funny climax, and ending with the line, does Jeff know, is really funny.
Yeah,
because he thinks that they're a couple.
Oh yeah.
Most valuable whatever.
Terry Garr, actually.
Excellent.
She's terrific, but the film really shortchanges her in terms of, you know, she's, especially the last scene she's in where she's like, okay, I'm heartbroken, but it's fine. I'll take these chocolates and I'm done.
Yeah, they make her seem like almost neurotic, yeah. Like she's the idiot or something.
And what she was asking for in that first scene when they've been in bed together is completely reasonable and he should just be honest with her.
Mm.
And he isn't. And so she gets more, she does get a bit sort of wilder and sort of more neurotic as the film goes on. And she's driving her mad.
And she lists those feminist books she's read in that last scene.
Yeah.
And I feel like, are they saying that's a negative thing?
Yeah.
Are they?
They're saying that she's, that it's a kind of...
Or is the film on her side? I'm actually not sure.
I don't think it is. I think, well, because it doesn't, she doesn't get a proper ending.
No.
So it can't be.
Mm.
But it's a common rallying cry. I know, it's like, I know my rights kind of thing. I've read these books, I know my rights. But if you've read those books and not understood them, that's really patronising. You might not be in that position because you wouldn't, you'd have more in your defences to sort of deal with a man like Michael kind of thing.
Mm.
So using the business, they're not self-help books, like feminist manifestos. And that's the sort of, it's a slightly misogynistic trope, but it's like, I know, you know, I read self-help, I can do anything kind of thing. I'm an empowered woman because I did this stuff. And it's like, it comes from a different place. And there we go.
Yeah. So Terry Garr.
Yes, sorry. Yeah.
I'm going for the woman who is uncredited on The Graduate and uncredited here, Elaine May.
Good.
Because, you know, she's not in the documentaries behind the scenes. She's not on the poster. But they all talk about her. I mean, it's not like they pretend she wasn't a big part of it. All the writers and the director and Dustin Hoffman all say Elaine May is the one who figured out the structure of this film, figured out a lot of the women characters, and worked out how all those lies could converge at the end, which is a complicated thing to do. And she's just a brilliant woman. So let's give her a shout, Elaine May. And if you could change anything, what would you change?
I think we need to give it an act three. So I think Michael has to do something that thematically is satisfying in order to win Julie back rather than just sort of doorstep her on the street and apologise to her. We should pull Sandy back into it. It should probably be during the play so that we get to see a bit of Jeff's play, because this play that's been put on in Syracuse is really built up and then we don't get to see any of it. So somehow, let's have the characters converge there, but then maybe give it a button in the city, because that'd be better. But it doesn't have an act three. It has two apologies, one of which is randomly in a bar that Les is kind of randomly in, and the other one just on the street, which repeats the beat. So it needs a good sort of 10-minute act three. Why not?
Jeff's play.
In Jeff's play, yes.
I've written down Jeff's play. We need to see Jeff's play, I think.
Yeah.
I think we need that climax. And maybe some of the learnings from this story are in the play. I don't know, but I think you're right. I think that's where it feels like everything's headed.
Yeah.
You've set it up. Pay it off. Okay, and that's your lot for Tootsie. No quiz this week, so let's look to next week. And it's my turn to clue again. though, because Alex was confused, he actually sent one over.
Great.
So let's do his clue, and if it's not good, if people don't like it, we can blame him.
Perfect.
So here is Alex's clue.
I'm excited.
You can run, but you can't hide.
Okay.
You can run, but you can't hide. That's Alex's clue. By the way, I was thinking, Alex really wouldn't have enjoyed this episode today, would he?
No.
No, it's probably good he's not. Okay. All right, that's your lot. If you want to follow us on the socials, we're at ClashPod on Twitter and Instagram. And if you want to do us a solid, please subscribe or write a review or force a friend to listen. And that really is your lot. So thanks for listening. And we'll be back on Thursday with Mrs. Doubtfire.
This was a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions
over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.